QST, QST, QST. This is Bruce, KK5DO, and it is once again time for another edition of the Houston AmSat Net. This net meets on Tuesdays to discuss topics related to satellites, balloons, and other amateur-related items. This is net number 1672, and it's 8 p.m. Central Time on Tuesday, July 14th, 2026. Which in UTC time is Wednesday, July 15th, 2026, at 0100. Sorry, this net is only being heard on Echolink and our normal streaming service, as I cannot reach the repeater from my house. And I'm not sure what's going to happen next week. I talked to Marty yesterday, and with the move, he's kind of hurt his back a little, and he may not be able to do the net next week, so we'll have to see what happens. I kind of got to get back into the AmSat Board of Directors calls, and it's the first and third Tuesdays of the month, so it's like, so we'll just have to see and play it by ear. On the AmSat News Service, the latest one for this week is ANS 193 for July 12th, so it's not too terribly old, just a couple days. And our first story, the May/June 2026 issue of the AmSat Journal is now available. So if you are a member, you could go to AmSat's member portal. You can reach it through amsat.org. And let's see, what's in this current issue? Of course, the Apogee View by Drew Glassbrenner, KO4MA. Educational Relations Update from Alan Johnston, KU2Y. CardSat, a full satellite station controller in your pocket by Paul Stutzer, N8HM. OrbitDeck, a free cross-platform satellite tracker, also by Paul Stutzer, N8HM. How Field Day Inspired My Parks on the Air Portable Satellite Station by Roger Weed, KV4I. Hamvention 2026 Takeaways had a record crowd and a signal for AmSat by Joe Kornowski, KB6IGK. And Hamvention 2026 Gallery, so you can see some of the nice pictures right there. AmSat UK Showcase at the Electromagnetic Field 2026, July 16th through the 19th. So amateur radio satellites will feature at the Electromagnetic Field EMF 2026 event taking place on July 16th through 19th. At Eastnor Castle Deer Park in Eastnor Ledbury, Herefordshire, in the UK. They like giving everything a bunch of names. So, the AmSat UK, the British Amateur Television Club, and the UK Microwave Group are teaming up to showcase satellite communications, amateur television, and microwave radio experimentation. Throughout the weekend, they plan to demonstrate how radio amateurs communicate via satellites in both low Earth orbit and geostationary orbit, including contacts and digital amateur television, through the QO100 satellite. They also hope to demonstrate microwave operating techniques and experimental radio systems used on the higher amateur bands. Visitors can see live satellite ground station setups, microwave equipment, and amateur television demonstrations, and learn how hobbyists build and operate space-related radio technology. The Village will also be active on the air using the EMF special call sign GB26EMF. For those attending the EMF 2026, the Amateur Radio Village will be open throughout the weekend to explore everything from video over radio to the upper reaches of the microwave spectrum. And we've got a link for that EMF camp village directory up on amsatnet.com. And let's see, that's going to happen here pretty soon. So if you'd like to see if you can work them on EMF or whatever they may be doing, give it a try and look at that EMF Camp Village directory. So SpaceX launched the latest in its Transporter series of rideshare missions July 7th as industry concerns increase about the program's future. A Falcon 9 lifted off from Vandenberg Space Force Base in California at 0712 UTC on the Transporter 17 mission to Sun Synchronous Orbit. The mission carried 81 payloads, according to SpaceX, including MarmotSat, a 3U CubeSat designed and built by students at the University of Victoria in Canada. Marina, a CubeSat built by Technical University of, it's in Slovakia, I'll go that far. Hades E2, a 1.5P pocket cube from AMSAT EA. Kostka, a 1U CubeSat from Brno University of Technology in Chechnya. Maverick, a 3U CubeSat from the University of Southern California. And let's see, MarmotSat carries a VHF digipeater uplink and downlink on 145.875 MHz. It's got a CW telemetry beacon on both 145.875 MHz and 29.410 MHz. It's got a DVB-S2 digital video beacon and linear frequency modulation sounding downlink, and both of those are on 29.410 MHz, of course, in the 10-meter amateur satellite allocation. They do have a separate telemetry tracking and command subsystem operating on 70 centimeters. So, after they get that a little bit commissioned, we should get some activity out of that. That VHF digipeater sounds like a lot of fun. If you're into looking at some of the digital video, the DVB-S2 digital signal will be your interest. Marina serves as an experimental communication platform providing global ham operators with an active digital transponder and Earth imaging capabilities. Let's see, the VHF downlink on 145.925 MHz for the digital transponder, and telemetry as well as a UHF downlink of 436.680 MHz for SSDV transmissions. Should be interesting. Hades E2, also known as UNNE-1B. Let's see, it carries an SDR-based FM and FSK repeater. It also broadcasts a Codec 2 digital voice message and includes an educational guessing game where clues are hidden weekly in its telemetry. Frequency coordination is in progress. Before you launch? But AMSAT EA has proposed a 145.925 MHz uplink for modes, FM voice with no subtone, and FSK 200 BPS. Actually, that may not be too bad if they're waiting on frequency coordination, because it is SDR based, so they can pick any frequency they like. So whatever they're assigned or whatever they've chosen, if approved, they just plug it in and away it goes. So I'll let them have that one. Kostka has a UHF downlink on 436.870 MHz for 9K6 AX25 G3RUH GFSK telemetry. Also has SSDV image transmission, a digipeater, and a CW beacon. So There we go again. Some more satellites with some ham two-way. Maverick carries a spectral imaging experiment and has a 9K6 UHF downlink using GOLAY framing with GMSK. And that you can find on 437.575 megahertz. Oops, got to reset for the repeaters. Sorry, KK5DO. Okay, there we go. Like other transporter missions, this launch carried a mix of new and returning customers, including those building out of or refreshing constellations. ICEYE had 4 radar imaging satellites on the mission, while Spire had 10 of its Lemur satellites on the launch. Axel Space, a Japanese Earth observation company, flew 7 of its GRUS-3 medium-resolution imaging spacecraft on the mission. These and other companies have relied heavily on SpaceX rideshares missions for a low-cost access to space on a regular schedule. However, there are growing concerns within the industry that SpaceX is winding down this program, at least using its workhorse Falcon 9 rocket. In recent weeks, several partners and customers of those rideshare missions said SpaceX is not accepting transporter reservations beyond late 2028 or early 2029. They added the missions on the manifest until then are nearly full. That has led companies like ExoLaunch and SEOPS, which have arranged launches on transporter missions, to buy their own Falcon 9 rideshare launches. SpaceX has not commented on those claims, and its webcast for the Transporter 17 launch did not discuss any changes to the rideshare program. However, anxiety extends to the availability of the Falcon 9 itself. SpaceX officials said last year they were near the peak of Falcon 9 launch activity and expected the number of launches to start to decline as the company ramps up Starship, its fully reusable heavy lift vehicle. That story comes from Space News, and we thank them for that, as well as information from the IARU. Okay, 14 million tracks and counting. Satellite Networked Open Ground Station, or SatNOGS, is the biggest open network of satellite ground stations in the world. It is run by volunteers and managed by the Libre Space Foundation. Essentially, it gives anyone with web interface to remotely schedule and control ground stations across the globe. One of the most significant aspects is that it relies entirely on regular people building their own setups at home. They use cheap, easy-to-find gear like a Raspberry Pi, a simple USB radio receiver, and basic antennas. Because the software handles all the tracking automatically using orbital data, the stations tune in and catch signals the exact moment a satellite flies overhead. On May 6, 2026, the network hit a massive milestone when it passed 14 million total observations. It was fitting for the amateur radio community that the record-breaking track happened to be LuSat, which was Argentina's very first mini-satellite. The network is incredibly busy right now, bringing in roughly 10,000 observations every single day. SatNOGS does more than just routine tracking. It has turned out to be an amazing tool for spotting when things go wrong in space. Back in May 2026, every day users looking at SatNOG's signal charts noticed something weird with India's Drishti satellite. By analyzing how the signal was fading in and out, independent trackers figured out that the spacecraft was actually tumbling in orbit at 3 degrees per second. This public data gave the world early proof that the satellite was in major trouble, months before official reports finally confirmed it was lost because of a solar storm. So, the benefits to the AMSAT community. For AMSAT organizations, SatNOGS offers distinct advantages. Global backup. A dense worldwide network ensures reliable backups if a local station misses a satellite pass. LEOP support. It helps teams identify and track new amateur spacecraft during the critical launch and early orbit phase, which is what LEOP stands for. Asset preservation. It ensures that historical assets like LuSat continue to be actively monitored by enthusiasts worldwide. The community makes public observations, waterfall charts, and transmitter details completely open to the public. Real-time tracking data, along with guides on how to build a local ground station, can be found on the official website. So, let's see what else we have here. And that story came from SatNOGS. So, the SWIFT Rescue Mission, or SRM, also referred to as the SWIFT Boost Mission, is pioneering satellite servicing project designed to recover and extend the life of NASA's Neil Gehrels SWIFT Observatory. Developed by Catalyst Space Technologies, the mission utilizes a robotic servicing spacecraft named Link to stabilize the observatory's orbit and prevent its uncontrolled re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere. So, key details of the mission include the objective. The SWIFT Observatory has operated since 2004, but after two decades, atmospheric drag has caused its orbit to decay significantly. Without intervention, there is a high probability that it would re-enter the atmosphere in 2026. The mission aims to raise SWIFT's orbit to approximately 600 kilometers to preserve its unique capability for detecting gamma ray bursts. The spacecraft, Link. Link is a 425-kilogram spacecraft equipped with two 6-meter solar arrays and three xenon-fueled ion thrusters. It features autonomous navigation systems and three robotic arms specifically designed for non-cooperative capture. Innovative methodology. This mission represents the first attempt to recover an unprepared spacecraft, one that has never designed with docking features or grappling points. Link will autonomously approach SWIFT, perform a visual inspection, and use its specialized robotic mechanism to secure a structural feature of the observatory without damaging its sensitive instrument. Current status. Link was launched on July 3rd from Kwajalein Island aboard a Northrop Grumman Pegasus XL rocket. Teams have successfully established communications with the satellite, which is currently undergoing several weeks of checkout procedures for its propulsion and navigation systems before beginning its rendezvous with SWIFT. Once the capture is secured, Link will spend several months gradually raising SWIFT's altitude before detaching and performing its own controlled re-entry into the atmosphere. And there's a note, as this mission is currently in its commissioning phase as of July 2026, further technical details regarding the final docking and reboost performance will be released by NASA as the mission progresses. And this story came from Reuters, and it was posted July 3rd, 2026. So let's take a quick stop for the repeaters to reset. And this is KK5DO. And continuing, we've got another satellite that was added to the TLEs this week. HOR-U HORYU-4. So it's got a NORAD catalog number of 41340. And let's see, Aris News. July 10th, they had a contact with the aerospace school named after the USSR test cosmonaut Sultanov, UD-9, or it was direct via UD-9W. So they had their contact. And nothing else. Okay, and Moon Day is coming up July 18th, so that'll be up in Dallas. You can always go to flightmuseum.com/events/Moon Day for more information. And the AMSAT Symposium, of course, is coming up October 8th through the 11th. And we're not going to beat that horse to death. We've mentioned it every week for the past few weeks. And let's see, over on Echolink, we've got KA5YFC Steve joining us, as well as N6UTC Endoff, AD0HJ, AG9P Damien, and KC8COS Chris. Thank you guys for joining in there. So the AMSAT South America, South Africa, AMSAT SA will have their 2026 Space Symposium Saturday, August 1st. The event is conducted online from 10 till 1400 South Africa Standard Time, which, it'll be 800 to 1200 UTC. To enable wide attendance without incurring large travel costs. The theme is the new amateur radio world in space, exploring practical hands-on aspects of space activities and emerging technologies. Presentations will include outcomes of proposals for new geostationary amateur satellites, including innovative ground-based systems to link LEO and GEO satellite. Registration is free for members of IARU member societies, while non-members pay a small fee. So you can visit the AMSAT South Africa website, and I think I do have that up on the website, amsatnet.com. NASA's Moon and Mars Exploration Analog, MMEA, continues to recruit research participants for its upcoming year-long simulation season. Because the mission's integrated habitats at the Johnson Space Center in Houston are designed to simulate deep space, participants will operate under the isolated conditions expected during crewed missions to the Moon or Mars. The current recruitment period is active for the year-long mission, beginning no earlier than August 2027, during which continuous simulation operations in confined environments could be possible. The mission is HERA/CHAPEA only. HERA is Habitat Spacecraft Simulation, and CHAPEA is Base Simulation. Volunteers are reminded to meet specific physical and educational requirements and to pass NASA's physical and psychological assessments so the mission results can be shared with human research program to help keep future astronauts safe and mission ready. And that story comes from NASA and the human research program and the Artemis mission. NSF-DOE Vera Rubin Observatory, and they have LSST after that, continues to reward the global scientific community as it begins its 10th year campaign to create the most comprehensive cinematic record of the universe in history because the observatory's 3,200 megapixel camera, the largest digital camera ever built, has successfully completed system optimization. It is now capturing new, detailed images of the southern sky approximately every 40 seconds. The current legacy survey of space and time, that's the LSST, runs through the next 10 years, during which continuous filming of the dynamic universe and the production of trillions of measurements should be possible. The survey is wide-field time-lapse only, producing 10 terabytes of data and up to 7 million alerts of changes in the night sky every night. Researchers are reminded to utilize automated alert brokers to classify these changes and to ensure timely follow-up of fleeting cosmic events, so this unprecedented resource can be shared by as many scientists and members of the public as possible worldwide. And this story came from NSF, DOE, NOAA Lab, and SLAC. And this week's news editor was, let's just go with Vidya, K4VGK. So we thank him for jumping in and doing it. I think this is the first week I've seen him as one of our editors, so he's new at it for us. So we thank him for doing that. Now, remember we've been talking about this for several months, that the TLEs are going to run out of numbers. Well, it's happened. John, KD2BD, reported that Celeste Track is reporting we ran out of the five-digit catalog numbers with the addition of Saramago on July 11th. So, starting now, the new numbers will begin with 100,000, and they will go from there. So you will not be able to get any new TLEs if you're not using one of the new formats and if your software does not accept the new format. So we'll see what happens now. It's like the 2000 worm that ran through and we had to change everything to go from 1999 to 2000. And we'll go ahead and take a pause here for the repeaters to reset. KK5DO. Okay, so there you have that new information that we've been waiting on, and we're going to now see what happens as we switch to six-digit catalog numbers from the five. And whoever thought we'd run out of the five, but it happened. Now, I found a few interesting stories. And the first one has to do with Voyager 1. So I don't want to read the heading, so we'll just go right into reading the story. It comes from Space Daily, and it was produced by their editorial team, published July 14th, so it's hot off the press. And here we go. On the 28th of November, 2017, engineers at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory sent Voyager 1 a command to fire four thrusters that had been silent since November 1980. The spacecraft was about 21 billion kilometers away, beyond the heliopause, and the team had to wait 19 hours and 35 minutes for the result to reach a deep space network antenna in California. The telemetry showed that the thrusters had delivered a sequence of 10 millisecond pulses exactly as intended. Hardware built in the 1970s had accepted a new job offer almost 4 decades of inactivity. Or after 4 decades. It is tempting to describe this as restarting Voyager's engines. That is not quite what happened. The small hydrazine thrusters did not accelerate the probe, though, or through interstellar space. They rotated it by tiny amounts, so its dish antenna remained pointed at the Earth. Voyager 1 communications through a 3.7-meter high-gain antenna at interstellar distances, a small pointing error can move Earth out of the antenna's narrow radio beam. Thrusters fire in brief puffs to correct the spacecraft's attitude and preserve the only link through which it can receive commands or return data. NASA's December 2017 account of the test says engineers had observed degradation in the attitude control thruster since 2014. They needed an increasing number of pulses to produce the same effect. More firings meant faster wear and greater demand on a finite propellant supply. The spacecraft carried another set of 4. These trajectory correction maneuver, or TCM thrusters, were identical in size and function, but they had been used during the Jupiter and Saturn encounters to adjust Voyager's path and aim its instruments. Voyager 1's final planetary encounter with Saturn and the TCM set last fired on 8 November 1980. So these dormant thrusters had never performed this exact job. During the planetary mission, the TCM thrusters generally operated in a more continuous mode. They had never been asked to provide the millisecond pulses used for routine orientation. Engineers could not simply switch branches and assume the control system would behave as expected. JPL assembled propulsion specialist Chris Jones, Robert Shotwell, Carl Guernsey, and Todd Barber to reconstruct how the dormant branch should respond. NASA says the team recovered decades-old records and examined software written in an outdated assembler language. They modeled possible responses before preparing the command sequence. So, the distance removed any possibility of real-time intervention. There was no joystick control and no way to stop the test after seeing an unexpected first pulse. The complete sequence had to be judged safe before transmission. By the time its result arrived at Goldstone, the physical event aboard Voyager had happened nearly 20 hours earlier. On 29 November, the telemetry showed that all 4 TCM thrusters had performed as well as the attitude control set. The spacecraft could use a system designed for trajectory changes during planetary flybys to maintain its antenna pointing during an interstellar mission. So why 37 years of silence did not necessarily ruin them? These were not engines with lubricated pistons or bearings sitting in air. They were MR-103 hydrazine thrusters developed by Aerojet Rocketdyne. Liquid hydrazine passed over a catalyst and decomposed into hot gas, producing thrust without a spark-based ignition system. Long dormancy still carried uncertainty. Valves could have failed, propellant pathways could have changed, and heaters had to keep components within acceptable temperatures. The successful firing showed that this particular branch remained functional. It did not establish that spacecraft hardware is preserved simply by leaving it unused. Redundancy was the decisive advantage. Both Voyager probes were built with multiple thruster branches because pointing control was essential during the original planetary mission. Decades later, engineers could assign a spare branch a role it had not been expected to perform for so long. A spacecraft passed from one generation to another. Voyager 1 launched on 5 September 1977 after years of design and construction by the 2017 test. It had been operating for 4 decades, long enough for original engineers to retire and for newer team members to inherit machinery older than their careers, and in some cases, older than they were. NASA has not published an age breakdown of the 2017 flight team, so that generational comparison is not a documented census. The underlying engineering problem is more revealing. The team had to recover design intent from old records, old code, and institutional knowledge accumulated across several eras of the mission. And let me pause here for a minute and we'll reset the repeaters. KK5DO. Okay. NASA's current Voyager technical overview says the probes use custom General Electric computers made to JPL specifications. Operating them is not a matter of installing modern spacecraft software on an old platform. Commands must respect an architecture that left Earth in 1977 and cannot be physically upgraded. Voyager project manager Suzanne Dodd said the revised thrusters could extend the spacecraft's operating life by 2 or 3 years. Voyager 1 switched to the TCM branch in January 2018. Voyager 2 made a similar change in July of 2019, according to NASA's account of the probe's power management plan. The reprieve did not halt aging. Each spacecraft's radioisotope thermoelectric generators lose about 4 watts of electrical output a year. Heaters, instruments, computers, and communications equipment compete for a shrinking power budget, while propellant lines and valves continue to change. In 2024, engineers had to move Voyager 1 to another thruster branch because silicon dioxide residue had narrowed tiny fuel inlet tubes. In 2025, the team revived a separate set of roll control thrusters considered unusable since 2004. Those later recoveries involved different components, but they followed the same operating discipline. Reconstruct the failure, identify a remaining margin, and accept only the risks necessary to preserve control. In April 2026, NASA shut down Voyager 1's low-energy charge particle instrument to conserve power, leaving 2 science instruments working. The mission now advances through carefully planned exchanges, one heater for another, one instrument for more time, one thruster branch for less obstructed one. The 2017 firing succeeded not because 1970s machinery somehow escaped aging. It succeeded because the original spacecraft carried useful redundancy, and a later team was willing to reconstruct that redundancy, what that redundancy could safely do. The machinery crossed a generational boundary along with heliopause. Engineers who did not design Voyager can still command it because records, software knowledge, and cautious operating practices have been handed forward. That chain is now as necessary to the mission as the surviving hydrazine and plutonium power aboard the spacecraft. So, that does it for that story. I do have a link to this story at amsatnet.com if you're interested in looking at it or, you know, following up on it or whatever. And I thought that was pretty darn neat. And here's another one. This also, it comes from spacenews.com. The author is Jeff Faust. I've read some other stories by him over the net. And it was released July 14th today. So, UK government preparing to release new space strategy. And this was in Washington. The British government is preparing to release a new space strategy that will provide a whole-of-government approach for space in the country. Speaking at the Space Tide Conference in Tokyo last week, Rebecca Everden, director of the UK Space Agency, said the strategy set for release in the coming weeks would provide guidance for civil, commercial, and national security space activities. That strategy will be framed around two outcomes, which are economic growth and national security, she said. Everything that we will do will be aligned with those two outcomes. The strategy, she said, will focus on four areas: satellite communications, launch, space domain awareness, and space sustainability, and in-space servicing and manufacturing. She didn't elaborate on those plans beyond accelerating development and investment in those areas. The government has already announced plans for new investment in national security space. The UK Ministry of Defence released on June 30th a defence investment plan that includes an additional £2.3 billion, which is $3.1 billion, for satellite communications and £880 million for space-based intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, or ISR, and space control through 2030. The funds would go to several projects, including a sovereign ISR, that, remember, is intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance system, and joint operations of deep space tracking radars with Australia and the United States. The strategy calls for an additional £9 billion of investment in space defense systems from 2030 to 2035, although it would not develop a Skynet 6 narrowband UHF satellite system as previously planned. National security, bringing together civil and defense priorities, is important, which strengthens our nation's resilience overall, she said. We'll focus efforts on the capabilities and markets that matter most in that context. She also emphasized the role of international partnerships for the UK. That included the great emphasis and importance of its role in the European Space Agency, and the importance of partnerships with the United States. Japan is another important partner for the UK, she said, calling the country a priority partner in the UK space strategy. She further said, "We have a lot in common, from the investment in space technologies to commitments to open markets and rules-based international order." Everden was in Japan as part of the UK delegation of the space company seeking to do business there. She said the breadth and quality of the 19 companies represented here underlines the depth of the UK capabilities and a strong appetite to work with Japanese partners. During another panel at the conference, she said the agency was working to help space companies in the UK expand globally. She further said, "Sometimes it's difficult to know where to start if you're a small company and you don't have experts in markets overseas." An example of a partnership in the other direction is Astroscale, the Tokyo-based satellite servicing company with an office in the UK. That office has grown from an initial 5 employees to nearly 200. What Astroscale saw in the UK was an indication that we wanted to focus heavily on space sustainability and debris removal, and they targeted the UK for that reason, she recalled. They thought we would be the ones who would license their first mission and that was correct. Everndon became director of the UK Space Agency in April, at the same time the agency, which had previously been an independent entity, was folded into the government's Department of Science, Innovation and Technology, or DSIT. Some in the UK space industry feared the move would diminish the role of the agency and the importance of space in British government. Everndon, who was previously director for space within DSIT, said the move has worked out well so far, creating a single agency for topics ranging from policy development to operations. We're responsible for coordinating and delivering right across the government on civil space policy, she said. What that does is allow us to have a stronger, coherent one government voice to share our ambitions and our goals, people right across the UK and internationally. And we'll go ahead and pause for the repeaters. Okay, this is KK5DO, and that ended that story. So it came from spacenews.com, published today, July 14th, and the author was Jeff Faust. You can get a link to that story at amsatnet.com. So we thank them for that. And, oh gosh, 8:46, time is flying right along. I don't see any more check-ins over here on Echolink. And I've just run out of information. How you like that? Let me see. I don't have any emails that have popped up that are satellite related. I got all kinds of other nonsense. We'll see what happens next week with Marty and see if I can do the net. I don't know. I missed a couple months of the AMSAT board meetings, so I kind of got to catch up there. So, that being said, we'll call it an end to the Houston AMSAT Net number 1672 for tonight. And hopefully we'll see you next week, or I'll be back the following week if Marty can't make it. So, we'll see. So, 73 to everyone. This is KK5DO.